All right, troops. Hello and welcome to That Mental Ginger Show with your host, Andrew Durning, aka The Mental Ginger. Now, my three faithful followers, two things have changed since the last video. First one is, I've had a well-deserved haircut. And the second is, I'm wearing Roy Orbison-style shades because, as many of you know, one of my sons blinded me in the summer and the injury just keeps recurring. So, of course, it's back today where I've got a very illustrious guest on. But we'll do our best, as we always do. And I might as well introduce the guest while I can. She is an actor, a singer-songwriter, a director, a poet. She's the host of the Am I Old Yet? The podcast and a voice and accent coach. Please welcome Floyd Kennedy. Floyd, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to get to know you over the last couple of weeks.
It's a great pleasure to be invited onto your show, Andrew.
Yes. So what I like to do is to start off with the guest's origin story because everybody's got one. So Floyd, please tell our audience your origin story.
Well, I will try to keep it short, Andrew, because it goes back a very, very long way.
Not at all.
I'm Australian. I was born in a little town called Yass, just outside of Canberra.
Wow.
In New South Wales. And then my family moved. So we moved a lot while I was a child. Mm-hmm. We moved from Yass to Caboolture, which is just north of Brisbane. And then we were on Thursday Island, which is at the top end of Queensland, the pointy bit that sticks up points to New Guinea. Mm. And then we were in Cairns, which is a well-known holiday place where Brits like to go and catch some tropical weather. Beautiful Daintree Forest is just inland from Cairns. Then we moved to Townsville, and then my dad got himself working on a little trading vessel up the coast of east coast of Papua, as it was back in those days. It was before independence. And he decided to set up a plantation. So my mother and my sister and I went up there. I was 8 at that point. And after 6 months of my mother trying to teach me school via the correspondence school of the air over the shortwave radio, she gave up and sent me off to boarding school with my sister in Townsville.
I mean to take note of boarding schools for when my kids grow up, but that's another story. So what was it like going to a boarding school? You hear all these things about, you know, boarding schools, like through, you know, the quote unquote media, but what was it actually like in a boarding school?
Well, it was a church school. It was run by Church of England nuns.
All right, and
it seems to me that there are two types of ways that you can react to boarding school. Some children love it. They love just being there with other children and they get on great, and others hate it. I come into the second category. I kind of always put it down to the fact that we moved around so much when I was a child that I never kind of learnt just how to just make friends and fit in. I'm still a bit like that. I still sort of sit on the edge of groups thinking, oh, they don't want to know me. And they're probably thinking I'm a bit of a snob. But I just, if anyone talks to me, I will talk back, as you have discovered.
Yeah.
I'm hard to stop once I get going. But I will wait to be asked.
That's just common courtesy. That's not being rude. I'm the same. I like to wait to be spoken to than just assume and jump in, because I get quite awkward if I do that, quite anxious. So how long were you at boarding school for?
5 years.
Wow. That's a Well, and do the parents like come and visit, or do you have like a summer holiday kind of break,
we had the summer holiday was, which is in Australia, that's over Christmas and New Year. Mm-hmm. So it was like 2 months. It would be at least eight weeks of holiday. But for most kids who were not traveling so far, they would go home for, you know, long weekends and the Easter break and the mid-year break. But for my sister and I, we only got home once a year. So we'd be farmed out, or she only had a couple of years there because she's much older than me. So I'd be farmed out to, there was one lovely woman. I thought she was so old. She had white hair. She's probably in her 40s. She was a friend of the headmistress of our school. And she lived on an island off the coast of, just off from Townsville, called Magnetic Island.
Wow.
And I thought she was really old, and I thought she lived in this huge house because it was a timbered house. And she had a bookcase. She had a bookcase. So I got to spend my holidays just working my way through all of the books on her bookcase. We went back to visit many years later when I was visiting Australia with my family, and we went to visit Auntie Jessie's house, and it's a tiny little house.
I always think that's the kind of saying, we know how people say that, you know, sweets seem to get like smaller these days. And I always think it's because we had them when we were so young, and maybe the bar was just big to us. Do you think that's maybe the kind of same thing that you thought with the house?
It could be. It could be. I really don't know. But you see, I also thought, because Magnetic Island to me was just a place where you went to go and stay at Auntie Jessie's for the holidays. And I just did my own thing. I read books, mainly sitting under a tree. That was it. If I went in the sun, I got burnt, you know, look at it.
Ginger albino right here. I get that.
Yeah, and on a Saturday night there would be a movie shown in the hall in Picnic Bay, and so we would hop on the bus and we would sing really, really old songs. You know, the old ladies, as I thought, in the bus would sing these old songs, and so it had this kind of dry, very sort of basic feeling to me. But years later, I had a friend who went from the UK to visit, and he came back with a beautiful coffee table book, and he said, Floyd, you'll be interested in this is Magnetic Island, it's the most beautiful place in the world. And I went, really? It's just got big trees and, you know, dry and stuff. And then I looked at these photographs, and it really is the most beautiful place in the world. But as a kid, you know, there you go.
You're looking for the excitement as a kid, and you just think trees, wow. But then as you get a bit older, you do appreciate nature a lot more.
Look up and look around, you know. I didn't do a lot of that as a child. I was just, where can I go and sit and make up stories in my head somewhere?
So how long did you stay in Australia?
I left Australia in 1966.
Wow.
Because I just wanted to be an actor. And in Australia in those days, we had this thing called the cultural cringe, which they've still got, but it's morphed into something else.
What is the cultural cringe?
The cultural cringe is everything that happens somewhere else is bound to be way, way better than what we've got here. Especially about arts and culture, you know. Theatre, for example, was England was where theatre happened. If it was here, it was just there, you know. It was the same with the visual arts. The artists, they mostly had to, you know, hop on a boat and get over to England or Europe, somewhere in Europe. If you went to Europe and then came back and said, I'm an artist, I'm an actor, but I've been to London, or I've been to Paris, then they would go, oh, you must be really good. That's the cultural cringe.
Right. Understand it now. So if you don't mind me asking, because I know something that's not appropriate to ask a woman her age, but how old were you when you came over to the UK?
I was 22, so you can do your sums from that.
No, don't worry. I'm rubbish at maths. You're only as old as you feel. So what encouraged you to pursue the arts?
I just only ever remember wanting to be in theatre. I wanted to act. I did have an aunt who was an actress. I didn't know it at the time. I only learned about it years later. She'd been a child radio actor.
Oh, wow. Doing the radio plays and things like that.
Radio plays, yeah. And my grandmother, apparently, my father's mother, apparently she was an opera singer back in the day, before I knew her, you know.
Well, I learned her was she soprano? Was she alto?
I've no idea. She never mentioned it, you know. I didn't know until I was well grown up, you know.
Wow.
No idea. But the first I can remember really being aware, well, two things. Before we went up to Papua and we were in Townsville, my sister would be forced to take me with her to the Saturday morning movies where they used to show things which weren't necessarily child appropriate, but that's where it was seen on a Saturday morning. Hmm. And I would see these old black and white movies made in the 30s about, you know, let's put on a show and being on Broadway and all that. Yeah. And I just decided that's what I wanted to do.
Wow.
I went to my aunt ran a dancing school. Mm. And so I went to her, I went to dancing lessons. And as soon as I was on stage doing my singing and dancing, I just went, yeah, this is what I'm going to do.
Brilliant. And so where did you move to when you came to the UK?
London.
London.
London was Mecca, the theatre. That's where you came.
So that must have been some ride, especially at London in the late 60s and the 70s. Wow, that to me, that just seems like, for me, my ideal time to be alive. You've got the discovery of rock and roll, you've got... At that point, you've had Elvis, you've had the Beatles, Johnny Cash, up and coming ones like David Bowie, Rolling Stones are all coming. I am so envious. Please tell me about it. What's it like? What was it like?
I'm
really giddy, like a school kid. I'm like, tell me.
It was, trying to think of just words, a few words to put into it. Had I been more emotionally mature, it probably would have been exciting and fabulous. As it was exciting and terrifying. I really, really did not know how to handle it. I was essentially a girl from several very small towns. And Brisbane in the 60s was known as the biggest country town in the world. Brisbane people hate it when you say that, but it was true. It was true, very, very parochial. There was no professional theatre in Brisbane at that time. Wow. There would be touring companies would come up from Sydney and Melbourne, but the regular theatre that happened in Brisbane in those years was there were three, what they used to call it, little theatre companies, amateur companies, but they were called little theatre. And there were three in Brisbane, which were actually really good. They were run by people who had experience of professional theatre. They knew how to make theatre in a professional way. And that was my training, was for 3 years in Brisbane before I left. I had working with two of those companies and learning my craft and learning how to make theatre. But remember that cultural cringe. So I'm there. I've been raised to think that what we do can't be all that great because it's just us. And then I got to London and immediately my friend Kathy that I travelled with, we just start going to the theatre. We went to the West End. You know, we're going to all the different, we'd go two or three times a week. And it was really boring and dull. And like, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that exciting theatre that I was, that I was there for.
Yeah. So you were kind of going around seeing the shows thinking, is this it? What's this cultural fringe that everybody talks about?
I thought there had to be something wrong with me, because how could I be sitting there watching this play? Oh, you know, don't something me, we're British, no sex, we're British. You know, it was all these farces.
Yeah.
And I wanted the real stuff. You know, I wanted the good, strong stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. In Brisbane, the year before I came away, we were doing Rita Tushingham's play, A Taste of Honey. Mm-hmm. We did The Knack. We did the one about Luther. It's called Luther, about the Diet of Worms, about Luther and his nailing. You know, really, really strong drama. And here we've got No Sex, Please, We're British. And I'm just thinking, oh, my God, this is culture. There must be something wrong with me, because I keep thinking we were doing better stuff in Brisbane, but that can't be right. I'm serious. I'm not joking, Andrew.
Wow.
That's how my thought processes were going.
Did it start to disillusion you from theatre if you were thinking, what? I mean, nowadays you probably think that maybe there was like a bit of anxiety about you or things like that.
Oh, totally. It was anxiety. It was actually, I was actually falling into clinical depression, you know, with the thought processes just going, it's your fault, you're stupid, you're an idiot, you know, all this kind of thing.
That, especially during that time when obviously mental health wasn't as predominant as it is now. How did you kind of bring yourself back from that? Well, because obviously it wasn't you. What, British theatre, as much as some of it is great, a lot of it, pardon my French, ish. And I know I worked at it.
This is what I had to learn. I mean, what was happening, the Royal Shakes, the RSC were doing stuff at the Aldrich Theatre, which was stunning, absolutely stunning. Glenda Jackson in US, Us, and the Marit Saad. And then at the Old Vic, the National Theatre was still being run by Laurence Olivier, with Maggie Smith and Frank Finlay and Robert Stevens. You know, that you could go there. You know, I could just live there. Thank you very much.
I think if time travel's invented, just put me back there. I'd be okay with that. Just some of the names that you've ran off, amazing.
Yeah.
So what direction did your career take kind of from that point onwards?
Well, I went to a party, which was a farewell party to some Australian guy who'd been here and he was heading back to Australia. Mm-hmm. And I happened to meet these Scottish guys, and one of them had a voice that deep chocolate sounding Scottish accent, and anyway, I married him.
I was not expecting that, but I'm so glad that you said it. That was fantastic.
Now, that is not to say that that's what sorted out my mental health, because that had its own challenges.
That would be such a great tagline: depressed, marry a Scot.
Yeah, marry a Scot. Yeah.
I think my wife would totally disagree with that, but aside from that.
he was as bad as I was, so we weren't particularly good for each other, you know. But you said, you know, what career path did I go? He was a folk singer.
Wow.
And so he turned me into a folk singer.
Did you go on tour? What is a married folk singing band?
We never made it to get into like being big enough to get invited on tours. But we were, you know, I don't know if you've heard of Ewan McColl.
Yes.
Okay. Well, he had set up a group called the Critics Group in his house in Beckenham in Kent with Peggy Seeger, his wife.
Mm.
And they attracted this group of folk singers, not to be a singing group, but to work on songs together and help each other and do and research. You know, this is the British folk revival.
Mm.
So they sent me along to meet Bert Lloyd, A.L. Lloyd, who had done a lot of folk collecting in Australia. Mm. And so he introduced me to Australian folk music.
It's so ironic that you find Australian folk music in Britain.
I know. I didn't know I knew anything. I had no contact with folk music that I knew of.
Was there a cultural cringe when you heard it? I've got to ask.
No, it wasn't, because I was hearing music the like of which I hadn't heard before.
Yeah.
Because the nearest thing that I knew of to any kind of folk music in Australia was what we'd called hillbilly music.
I could just picture it there.
I mean, for example, there was a girl at school who used to sing this song at concerts. It used to go like this. My story begins on the wide open plains out Cloncurry Way, where seldom it rains. And it had to be sung in this very nasal sounding voice. But
yeah, it's got that kind of twang, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. But the actual the songs that that Bert Lloyd had collected, you know, there's some amazing ballads.
Yeah.
And also there was a singer called Sally Sloan,
mm-hmm.
that another chap, John Manifold, had recordings of, and she just had the most wonderful, strong voice, you know, mm-hmm. a little bit like Jeannie Robertson,
yeah.
a little bit like her voice, yeah, oh. yeah. So, yeah, that was an education.
Mm. So how long did the folk band last?
Well, Danielle and I worked together. You know, we were like individual singers, but we would accompany each other and perform together. So we would, you know, perform around various folk clubs, you know. We got married in 68 and not long, no, that's right, 71, just after our first son was born, we decided to move up to Scotland because his family all came from the Isle of Tiree.
Ooh,
and he just wanted, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to live on Tiree and write. Yeah. He wanted to be a novelist, you know.
Mm.
And then this property came up for sale. And so we got some funding and a bit of a bank loan and shoved the baby and pregnant me into the car and headed for Tiree.
Oh, I can just picture it. Man, that's crazy. It sounds a bit like a Chevy Chase movie.
It was a bit. We packed all our furniture and stuff and shipped it. And when we got to Tiree, our shipping container didn't arrive for another 6 weeks. So there we were in the house with no furniture.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But Tiree being, you know, it's an island, it's highlands, so mm-hmm. to speak. And the people are just gorgeous and, you know, they lent us stuff and, you know, we got by.
So your adventure is like so fascinating already. It's taken us from Australia to London and then up to Tiree. Where did the journey go from there? This is fascinating to me.
Well, I did tell you I've had a lot of years to pack a lot of stuff into. So let me know if you ever want me to jump ahead.
Not at all. If I could keep this going longer, I would. I might have to get you back for a second part so I can hear more.
Oh, right. Well, we opened a licensed restaurant. Well, the first year it was just a cafe.
Yeah.
And we found that we couldn't really earn, you know, a living. It just wasn't profitable. So we managed to get a license and made it a little bit posher, so to speak, serving steak and lobster thermidor and stuff that.
Definitely taking the performing stereotypes with you.
But the problem was we had no idea how to run a business, no business at all. And we were going bust at a rate of knots. Then there was a fire and we had to close down. So, yeah. So in an effort to get a job that actually paid enough money so that we could get ourselves out of debt, Daniil, my husband, got himself a job in Nigeria.
Wow.
Yeah, because his day job was he was a quantity surveyor.
Yeah.
And they paid lots of money in Nigeria. They had a big building construction boom going, you know, and so he got a job. And so I followed out with the two kids, and we were there for 4 years.
Wow.
In Lagos.
The pot with a good gravy thickens. How did you find it in Nigeria?
Hot, which I loved. I was raised in the tropics, and I was still enjoying the heat, but everything, you know, our houses were all air conditioned, so didn't bother me. And it wasn't quite as bad as like North Queensland, where if I was in the sun for 10 minutes, I got burnt.
Yeah.
In Lagos, it didn't seem to be as harsh on my skin. So I was able to, you know, not get burnt, basically. Mm. Lots of sunscreen, but don't get burnt.
Yeah. Did you get a tan? I've got to ask.
I actually, the first tan I ever had was in London. When I was expecting Ian, and I got myself one of those banana beds, you know, that fold out lounges with the plastic strips going round and round and round.
Yeah.
Well, we call them banana beds. And I was the summer that I was expecting Ian, because he was born in October. Mm. So the summer I would in the afternoon, I would go and rest outside in the garden on the banana bed. And I actually got a gentle golden tan in the English summer.
Oh, wow. Of all the places to get a tan, it had to be London.
It had to be London, yeah. But so no, nice. I didn't get a tan in Nigeria. No, I couldn't stay in the sun long enough for that to happen.
So you were in Nigeria for 4 years. Yeah. So 4 years, where was it? Where was your next port of call?
Glasgow.
Oh,
yes.
Here we go. This is getting exciting.
Well, I tell a lie. Renfrew.
Ah, just outside of Glasgow.
Just outside of Glasgow, yeah.
So what brought you to Glasgow? Was it through your husband's work again?
Yes, it was. It was just coming home, you know. We'd managed to buy a brand new Barrett house.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had enough money to put a decent deposit on it. You know, we'd paid off all our debt, and enough money to put the deposit on the on a new little semi-detached Barrett house in Renfrew.
Wow, that's lovely.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Yeah, well, what happened next was I came back with the kids, and Daniil was doing sort of 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off for about 18 months, and then finished up with them. And so we were there for about 5 years, and then we moved to Langbank. Langbank bought a lovely big old Victorian villa type place that was falling to pieces, and the plan was that Daniil loved doing woodwork, so he would do it up and write, so that lasted about 6 months, and we were running out of money. So I got a job in Port Glasgow running drama workshops with the kids.
Good. How long did you do that for?
A couple of years. Yeah.
Three years. Were you still doing performing when you were in Nigeria and places like that?
Yes, I directed a play for the Ikoyi players. Ikoyi is an island that's part of Lagos, but it's actually an island where all the expats live.
Wow.
And they had their own sort of drama, amateur dramatic society. I direct the play that I chose. You know, you write off to French's for, you know, scripts. So you look through the catalogue, and I thought, oh, there's a four-hander that's set in Caithness. That would be fun. And of course, the plague comes, and it's set in Caithness in the middle of winter. So the four actors are all in Aran sweaters and parkas and things, absolutely dying.
Oh dear.
It's a wonder nobody died. Anyway, I had fun. And the other thing, I did take part in a couple of operary things that they did. I got it in the chorus just. And, oh, no, there was a concert at the American Ambassadors. People were invited to trot up and do, you know, audition sort of thing. Solo, the woman that was organising it, she ran the Akoi Singers. And the ambassador, and I did a couple of numbers. I did I'm Just a Girl Who Can't Say No. the American ambassador was actually from Oklahoma, and he congratulated me on my accent, so I was very chuffed with that.
That's amazing.
So that was sort of expat stuff that you do.
So you were doing the drama teaching for a couple of years for the kids. So what was the next step?
The next step was a friend was working for the newly formed Scottish Theatre Company. It's not the Scottish Theatre Company you've got now. It's the one that Tom Fleming set up in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And they wanted to do, they were casting for Macbeth.
Ooh.
And so I was asked if my two boys would like to play young Macduff and Fleance.
Wow. How old were your boys by that point?
Ian was 11, so Roddy would have been nine and a bit.
Wow.
Now, Ian was always a very sociable child, you know, very outgoing. Mm. Roderick was very reserved. Just reserved, you know, he would, quiet to himself. And so I came home and I said, look, here's a thought, would you be interested? And they had just not long before that, there'd been some Shakespeare play the BBC had had on the television, and I'd been sitting and watching it, and the kids had sat and watched it with me. I didn't make them, they just did. And I thought, I said, would you like to do some Shakespeare, to play, be in a Shakespeare play? Ian said, oh, yeah, love to. And Roddy, very wise young man, he said, how many people would be watching?
Wow.
I said, well, we're talking about the Theatre Royal, so I think it's about 1,500. And he said, no, I couldn't do that. I said, okay,
Well, definitely very wise for his age. That was
very wise,
Very good. So how did your, find it?
So I took Ian along to be auditioned, and I took one of the lads from one of my workshops. In Port Glasgow, Stephen Doherty, still performing professionally in Scotland.
Yeah. Second you said the name, it rang several bells.
Yes, well, that's how he got his first break. Yeah. Stephen played, he was older and taller, he played Fleance, and Ian played young Macduff. So I was the nanny, the chaperone for that. where was my career? My friend Sue.
It's a very varied and interesting career. It's so fascinating what you've done up to that point.
Something different all along the way.
Yeah.
It could be that I get bored easily. or
I think
it's
the performer in you. I wrote some of my CV and goes, you've had quite a lot of jobs, but it's because with that performing part of us, we're always looking for the next script, the next challenge, something to stimulate the brain and inspire us. And that's just what happens. We don't fit that kind of 9-to-5 mold. We've got to have that constant.
Not at all.
So what was the next stimulation for you then, Floyd?
The next thing was working at the King's Theatre for the Christmas pantomimes as a dresser.
Oh, brilliant. How was that for you?
I did it for 3 years, and I think it was the second year, the wardrobe mistress actually was going on leave, so she appointed me deputy wardrobe mistress. So I did that for about 6 months. sort of, you know, fixing up costumes. My mother was a dressmaker and she taught me to sew, and I love sewing. So, you know, that sort of fitted okay. But yeah, no, I was Gregor Fisher's dresser one year.
Wow.
And I got to pull his bald cap off, or his wig off, so that you could see, it looked as if he had a bald head underneath. He's lovely. He's a great guy to work with. Yeah. So I did that, and I discovered that, having decided all those years ago in London that I was not an actress, I wasn't very good, obviously, I was never going to be able to do that, and so I just wouldn't do that. And here I'm standing in the wings every night thinking, I could do that, you know, as you do, I could do that. And then I discovered there were two others of the dressers who were doing exactly the same thing, saying, oh,
Everybody does that, though, no matter what you are. You just go, I could do that.
I could do that, yeah. You know the joke, but how many actors does it take to change a light bulb?
I know the joke, but for our listeners, tell us the punchline.
It only takes one, but you've got to have 99 standing around saying, I could do that.
It never gets old. It never gets old. So we are coming up on time, but I will need to have you back to hear the rest of the story, because it's just too fascinating to me. Well, I want to talk about your podcast, the Am I Old Yet, the podcast. So what inspired you to get into the podcasting game?
What inspired me was, it started as a friend down in London asked me if I would write a sketch, 10-minute. They were running it for a community theatre in Surbiton, running a competition for people to put material onto the website, you know, in the beginning of lockdown. It was March last year.
Yeah.
And it was January this year. What month are we? Yeah, this year, January.
There we go.
Lockdown brain, I'm telling you.
Oh, I know that feeling. That's not exclusive to anything.
Yeah. Anyway, long story short, I wrote two 10-minute sketches, but it had to be audio only and you had to record it yourself. Now, I live here on my own, so I wrote this and I did all the voices and I recorded them separately and I edited them together and I sent them off and one of them got accepted and the other one didn't, but the comments I got from the judges were both, oh, these are really, really entertaining and they're very well produced and they're really great, but they sort of finished too soon, you know? They should have gone on, but there was a time limit. And I thought, you wanted more? I'll give you more. So, and I thought, well, I'll just put them on my website. So I just wrote another couple of them and stuck them and put them on Facebook. And then I thought, it must be an easier way, isn't it? What is this thing that podcast people do? So I did a bit of research. I found Buzzsprout. And I've been doing it ever since, apart from a three-week break a couple of months ago when I spent my 3 weeks writing more episodes.
It's the performer in you, like, you, even when you're taking a break, you're not taking a break. Like, the wheels always turning.
I just don't do holidays. I never did, really. Don't understand the concept. Yeah, but the thing with the podcast is that once I got going, as far as I'm concerned, I'm making theatre.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is, you know. So I write the scripts. If they are
thank you
Alexa's trying to join in the party.
She wants, she's reminding me to put my eye drops in.
Okay, you get some for me as well, please.
There you go.
just a Zoom drug deal, it's all right.
Yeah. So I write the scripts. If they're characters that I can play, I play them myself. If they're not, I invite friends. And so far, I've got friends in Australia, in America, in Liverpool, in London, I haven't actually got any in Scotland, although Mark Kidd has agreed to do one for me. I'd forgotten about Mark. I must get onto him. I must write an episode. So that's kind of how it happens. I think of another friend who's an actor, and I say, would you like to do an episode? And they say yes, and then I write the episode for them.
That's brilliant. Well, I wish you nothing but success with it, because it sounds like such a fascinating concept. I have listened to a couple, but I'll definitely be trying to get into more of them as soon as I can, just when I've got a bit. When I get into a project, I just dive in head first and I'm just right in amongst it.
Yeah.
So the final question that I'll ask you after almost 40 minutes of grilling. Your story's just so fascinating, Floyd. Like, I couldn't stop you. I didn't want to stop you, but sadly we do have to come to an end at some point. So if you could give one piece of advice to anybody that is struggling with mental health issues, what would that piece of advice be and why?
I would say these thoughts that you're having about your life, ask yourself this question: are they true?
Mm.
Am I telling myself the truth, really? Are they logical? Do they make sense? If they don't make sense, go and see a professional.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Really good.
Talk to somebody. But basically, you need to talk to somebody that knows how this stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's my experience of mental health, mental ill health, is that the thoughts that you're having, those terrible negative thoughts,
mm-hmm.
they are not actually your thoughts. They're just your brain chemistry playing little games and coming up with these things, and they're always going to be negative.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are negative, nonstop negative, then your brain chemistry is out of whack. And you need help. You don't necessarily need chemical help, you know,
mm-hmm.
But it's there if you do get. It's like, you know, if you get an infection, if you just cut your finger and it's a bit sore, you can put some ointment on it, it'll get better. But if it gets really badly infected, you have to go to the doctor and get antibiotics. And if it gets gangrenous, they've got to do an operation, you know. So it's just your mental health works exactly the same way.
Yeah.
It's degrees, and there are different kind of, you know, ways of being ill that exist. Mm. And so it's good to get some professional advice. And then if you can handle it yourself, do so. But it's like anything else, it's like a muscle that you have to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've found. I have to practice. I have to do my practice of staying healthy. Just the same way you've got to, you know, keep your muscles toned up. You've got to keep your brain toned up with good stuff. Nourish it.
It's a really good bit of advice, Floyd. Well, thank you so much. So for the final part of the show, we come to Ask Andrew Anything. This is where, after me grilling the guest for so long, it gives them a chance to ask me a question, and I have to be 100% honest, and no topic is off limits. Floyd, do you have a question that you would like to ask me?
I do, but it's probably a bit unfair and you may not have the answer, but question is, it's the same question that every podcaster is asking all the time. How can I get the word out? I'm doing theatre about an old woman who's got, you know, talks with her friends, and occasionally, but they're not all the same age as she is. But essentially, it's from coming from her perspective of life as she is living it at this moment in time. It doesn't fit into any niche.
But in a way, that's what makes it so unique, because it's its own niche.
Yeah, but
it's how you brand it. That's what's going to make it. One of the examples that I'm doing is I am going to be setting up a podcast next year about Thomas the Tank Engine. And it's about the original Railway series books and we're going to be reading them, getting voice actors to read them. We're going to go into the history of the stories, like the real life incidents, things like that, and try and decipher if Thomas really was like more than a children's book, because it has quite a large adult following. Mm-hmm. And that's a very specific niche that I never thought existed until I did a little bit of research to it. And the things to do for that is to go on to Facebook groups and do a little bit of kind of market research. Your stuff is theatre, put online theatre, go on to the theatre maker societies in Facebook, theatre opportunity works, the casting opportunities as well, because you're looking for people to act out some of the scripts. So that's a possibility. And instead of trying to say that it doesn't fit a specific niche, embrace the uniqueness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what makes it so appealing. At least it makes it so appealing to me. It's mm-hmm. fresh, it's unique, it's a perspective that no one's really discovered yet. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted John, because it's fascinating. I may not have lots of views or lots of followers on my side, but if at least one person hears it and goes, I want to check that out, mm-hmm. it's made a difference. That's one more person than you had yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So don't be afraid to embrace the uniqueness and just enjoy the hustle while you can. Enjoy being the outsider, like the kind of the anti-establishment, kind of fits in with the 60s, 70s growing up in London, doesn't it? Enjoy the fact yeah. that yours is a little bit different and a little bit quirky. It's the same with the title of my show. Everybody goes, that's such an interesting title. And I'm like, well, when you break it down, it's because I've got ginger hair and I've got mental health issues. It's not exactly rocket science, but it's something that's unique, and it's unique to you as well. And if people like it, they'll catch on, and people are starting to catch on. You just got to just keep plugging. And if you need a help with anything, I'll speak to you afterwards. I'll round up some contacts that I know and try and help get the word out, because it should be out there. You've got such a fascinating story to tell. And I really want our listeners to hear it, and I want more people to hear it, just like any guest that I bring on. Hopefully that's helped and it wasn't just rambling, but I did try.
No, that embrace the uniqueness. It's like, hello.
Sometimes it takes the performer to speak to a performer, doesn't it? You can get all the marketing research under the sun, but sometimes it just takes someone that's in the same mindset to strip it down to the nuts and bolts.
That's right.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Just hearing about your life is so fascinating. And I really do hope that you come back on later on and we can hear part two of your journey, and hopefully your uniqueness has become a bit less unique because more people have started to follow it.
Yeah. But
keep chasing it. And you've made my day, especially since I've had a rubbish day with my eye and not feeling well. You've really put the smile back on my face. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks. It has been for me, Andrew. It really has. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So until next time, listeners, this is Andrew Durning. You have been listening to the wonderful, talented and beautiful Floyd Kennedy. So until next time, take care. Stay safe. Bye-bye.